With the start of school, it helps when you're beginning a class to recognize what kind of a class you're taking. There are different classes, different styles of teaching, different classrooms, and the more that you can know of the specifics around that class, the more likely you'll be to succeed. Generally speaking, in the sciences, there are a couple of different kinds of classes, and they're often leveled or layered. There are theory classes, or classes that you're in a classroom with a textbook learning about the theory of some idea, or you are learning the basics of that idea. Those kinds of classes are often followed or intended to be a prerequisite for a laboratory class. This is true with biology, chemistry at the earliest levels, even in high school, but through college, graduate school. There is a theory class, and then the lab, or an identification class, and then a practice. This is true in the arts as well. It can be in the humanities or the industrial arts. Here we are learning about the basics of this idea, and then we're going to have the next semester a class to practice this. So we have theory, we have identification, and then we're going to go and practice it. I was good at the theory classes. I didn't do so well in the labs. I don't know about you, but I was able to do often okay in the I can read a book, I can see what they're saying, and I can visualize, and okay, that's all good. But sometimes when it came to the lab class, I didn't do as well. With those cadavers, I struggled. Is that the superior vena cava or the inferior vena cava? I just can't remember how that works. Industrial arts class, okay, how does this acetylene thing work again? And here comes the teacher rushing over. You're going to blow the place up. I knew it in the book, right? Jesus' teaching in Luke 8 functions really according to that framework. In Luke 8, as we have in the other parallel Gospels, Matthew and Mark, Jesus, one of his most famous teaching, the parable of the soils, Jesus likens himself to a sower who is scattering seed broadly. And that seed is the word of the kingdom that has come. And Jesus is scattering it about. And that parable cuts in two directions. It explains why some are hearing, because God has given them ears to hear and others don't. And so it has a sense of division, but it also has a sense of calling those who can hear to heed that message, to bear fruit, to stick with it over the long haul. So it separates, it moves away those who don't have an ability to hear, those who haven't been touched by God to hear His word and follow, and those who have, it has the effect of drawing them in, to bear fruit, to recognize their privileged position as the one-fourth of the soils in the parable that actually bear fruit. In some ways, what we have at the outset of Luke 8 could be called the theory class. Here's how things work. It's a textbook. Here's one soil, and here's why it doesn't. Here's another soil, here's why it doesn't. Here's a soil, why... And here's the fourth soil. This is the good soil that heeds the word with a good heart and bears fruit over time. This is the way it works. This is the textbook. Go read it, okay, I understand this. And it's as if the rest of Luke 8 becomes a laboratory class. Let's see how the disciples respond when tested. Let's see what happens when the word is scattered in a foreign region. Let's see if there's any good soil around that might bear fruit. And what we find in the flow of Luke 8 is the good soil is described as one man here, an outsider, a foreigner, who is compelled by God's love and forgiveness and power and dominion over demonic authority, casting out a legion of demons that had controlled him, and he is freed, and that freedom compels him in a very courageous way to witness. This is good soil. This is producing a crop a hundredfold. The laboratory begins midway through Luke 8, or about a third of the way through. We'll look at some of the laboratory class today. Next Sunday, we'll continue on through the rest of Luke 8 and notice how the arrangement of what Luke has here provides an illustration, a laboratory of these four soils. What you see me trying to do is synthesize Luke 8. I'm going to pause just a moment and talk about how we know what we know in the Gospels. There is here, as well as the story or narrative material of the Old Testament, the necessity of reading forward and reading backward. Reading forward to understand ideas and then see how, looking back, those have been foreshadowed in some way, and then beginning to synthesize. The best biblical interpretation, not only of the Gospels or historical books of the Old Testament, but I would argue the epistles and even Revelation, is to see them holistically, moving from small sections to broader. It's been described as a circle or a spiral of interpretation, where we start with a small section and move out and see how the broader previous and later instances or scenes might be able to help us interpret this one. It's one thing to say context determines meaning, but then to go and apply it in the Gospels to see how the big picture is coming together. I've tried to do this with Luke's Gospel by nearly every week calling our attention to Luke 4. Start with me there. If you're open to Luke 8, just jump back to Luke 4. And I've tried to draw our attention to the fact that here in Nazareth, when Jesus goes into the synagogue there, and he's handed the scroll of Isaiah, and he opens it up to Isaiah 61, and he gives this great prophecy here and interprets it about himself, that this casts a shadow all the way until Luke 9. So I'm thinking with you about small and large. Small unit, Luke 4, verses 16 and following. If you pick it up with me in verse 18, the Spirit of the Lord is on me. This is Isaiah 61. Jesus found this place. It's a purposeful text. It's not happenstance. He's wanting to show that something is happening, something profound and wonderful. It's in fact the end times. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because He has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed. Verse 19 is key. To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. We should see in the scattering of seed that very proclamation. There's a sense in which what Jesus states prophetically in Nazareth in Luke 4, the author Luke, under the inspiration of the Spirit, expects us to keep in mind by the time we're at chapter 8. There's a sense in which we're expected to connect the dots. And that's what I want to do with you this morning. This scattering of seed is no normal message. It's not just another prophet. And Jesus demonstrates that here in Luke 4, 5, 6, and 7. It's miracle after miracle. Casting out demons already in Capernaum in Luke 4, in a synagogue. He heals a boy who's dead. He does miraculous works and proclaims that there he's forgiving sin. All of those instances, friends, are illustrations of what he said he was doing in Luke 4. Connect the dots. He's powerful. He is God's anointed. He is the Son. He has come. Give heed. Pay attention. This is not just another prophet running around. So when he suggests in the parable of the soils that it's like someone scattering seed, take heed. This is not just something that could be cast off and it's no big deal. Oh, he's just giving a message and it's not really a big deal if I heed it. It's, you know, it's just seed. I scatter seed all the time. It's no big deal. I tried to grow grass this summer, earlier in the year, multiple times. I don't know how many times I wasted water and it didn't grow. It looks terrible. It's just normal seed. I'm out there trying to sow it. Some farmers go sow seed, just hoping it comes up, or they have an exact program. They're pretty sure it's going to come up, know it's going to happen, weather permitting, all the rest. Jesus' word is not just seed normally scattered about. This is end time seed. This is the anointed prophet of the Lord who has come and who forgives sins, who casts out demons, who heals the dead. This seed should be heeded. That's the point. He should be trusted. There should be a response. So we move in Luke 8 from theory to lab. What is going to happen in the laboratory? And we see a narrative progress. Jesus calming the sea to the disciples, and they are concerned for their own lives, not trusting God. We understand in the broad scope, they are good seed. They will bear fruit. But here, it seems like they resemble the soil that doesn't have any root, a rocky soil. When testings come, there's a falling away. We know the parable of soils is broad scope, but it seems that it's almost, here's an illustration of what not to do. Trust God in danger. Jesus goes across the lake, and there are people who are amazed when Jesus heals this man who's been dominated by a demon. And they're gripped with fear because the worries of life, the deceitfulness of riches, challenge them. And they want him away from them. It's like that thorny soil. And yet there's one man who represents good soil, if you will. How Jesus is unpacking the parable of the soils in a laboratory kind of sense. You can see how this is taking an effect in the progress of the text. Now, Jesus doesn't mention these directly. They seem to be sort of indirect, connecting the dots. Here is one instance, and I've just talked about this kind of soil. Here's another instance, just talked about this kind of soil. But this is the lab class. This is where it matters. And what we conclude with is that this good soil looks like a man who courageously, because of what he has received, witnesses of the kingdom. And this is what compels us. It's personal experience. It's what God has done in our lives. Forgiveness of sin, righteousness, eternal life, grace, church fellowship, these swelling in us to bear fruit. Join with me in the progress then of the text, thinking about what compels Christian witness. Notice Jesus' authority over the elements of nature, and this before the disciples in their worriedness about this life. Verse 22. One day, Jesus and his disciples got into a boat. He told them, "Let's cross over to the other side of the lake." So they set out. As they were sailing, he fell asleep. You're familiar with the story. Verse 23, what happens? great storm comes. Fierce wind came down on the lake. They were being swamped and were in danger. They came and woke him up saying, "Master, Master, we're going to die," verse 24. This was their situation. Their frame of reference is that the elements around them are of greater strength than Jesus with them in the boat. He is asleep somehow in the midst of a great storm, and they are frightened at these elements. Despite what they have seen Jesus do, despite the healings, despite the exorcisms, despite all he has done, there's great fear. Kent Hughes writes, "Though their fear was natural, they had little excuse for their lack of faith. They had seen the centurion's servant healed and the Nain widow's son raised from the dead. Even more, they had been with Jesus night and day for 3 years. They had observed his perfect character, soaked up his divine words. But in their fear, they had abandoned all spiritual logic. How like us," Hughes concludes, "except that we have even less excuse. Fear comes, and all the reasons for trust depart. All our past experience, all the knowledge God has given to us." It's one thing to read this here in Luke or Matthew, Mark, or John, this instance recorded in all four Gospels, to read it in each one to remember the scene. And what it does is provide a reminder, first, of Jesus' power, second, of the progress of the disciples. They're yet in school. They are still learning. And encourages us to trust God in our situations, mindful of how much more. Mindful of Jesus' resurrection, mindful of forgiveness, the presence of the Spirit in us. Friend, let us learn together from the disciples and their statement to Jesus, "We are going to perish," that God is caring for us in the midst of life's circumstances, whatever we would define them to be, sometimes feeling like storms, sometimes like placid waters. God's care for us is the same, it is constant, and in whichever situation, it is about a disciplined spiritual logic of seeking Him. There's a sense in which this miracle where Jesus calms the storm is a gentle reminder for us today as well, "I've got this." In the storm trial, however we would want to describe it, whatever level or label we would provide, "I've got this." Be it a placid situation of life, "I've got this." Sometimes, ironically, the placid situations are just as dangerous because we go on thinking things are just natural and okay, and we relax ourselves a bit. We lower our defenses. We put our feet up from seeking God with a sense of urgency. And then, temptation comes. Our MCG has just memorized 1 Peter together. Not all of us the whole book, but as a fellowship of a group, kind of a scriptorium. One person memorizing this and this. And so we went around this last Wednesday night, and each person recited their part. And I worked some in chapter 5, and I was reminded how urgently Peter is exhorting his audience to seek God. Be alert. Your adversary, the devil, is prowling around like a roaring lion, seeking anyone he can devour. Resist him, firm in the faith, knowing that the same trials are being endured by your brothers in the world. There's a sense of urgency in the placid waters, not just the storms of life. The devil is seeking to defeat us in all circumstances. We hear a lot of songs about the storms and God getting us through the storms. Beware, those placid waters are full of danger. there is a sense of urgency seeking God every day, regardless of what the calendar has, regardless of what the demands are. There's a sense in which spiritual logic says, I am going to seek you first, no matter what the circumstances are. If I could make one further point of just pastoral application, this is where Scripture memory can be especially helpful. Running Scripture through your mind throughout the day, various passages that you have memorized, and when you have a moment where you're overwhelmed, or there's just I've just finished something and now there's a blank moment before me, and so I don't have anything to think about right now, nothing exactly urgent, these 10 seconds, run to Scripture. There's a sense in which there you have protection, strength, so that whether it is a storm season or the waters are calm, you are on the offensive. The disciples were on the defensive. Verse 24, we left off. They came and woke Jesus up. Master, Master, we're going to die. They weren't praying. They aren't seeking God and what they would know of. They're just crying out because they think they're going to die. Jesus got up and rebuked the wind, the raging waves. They ceased in absolute calm is the imagery. There was a perfect calm. From violent storm suddenly to perfect calm. You may have been around the ocean at the tide going in or out. You recognize that there is a progress in the tide going out or coming in. And it slowly goes out and moves in. But there's a progress in it. The imagery of the verse here, as in the other Gospels, is that there's no progress. There's violent movement of water up and down to the point that experienced fishermen are afraid, to absolute flat calm. Jesus displaying his power, and in verse 25, speaks a word of it. Where is your faith? It's a rebuke by interrogation. Where's your faith? Then they were fearful and amazed, asking one another, who can this be? He commands even the winds and the waves, and they obey him. The disciples are in progress, and Jesus is powerful. It's these kind of reflective statements that Luke has provided along the way. Jesus does something, and he provides this interpretive reflection. They were amazed. The word went out about him. There was fame. And each one leads to the next. There's a cumulative effect if we follow the text. Notice verse 26, scene 2. That is, what has been recognized about Jesus should continue on with us as we read the next scene. Then they sailed to the region of the Gerasenes. It's opposite Galilee. This is the southern end of the Sea of Galilee, on the far side of the Jordan River, the east side. This is Gentile country. Jesus had been in Galilee and Capernaum. Though it's in the north, it's in Galilee, it's not in Judea. It's in the north. It's still highly Jewish influence. There are synagogues, and we hear talk of synagogues. Next week, we'll notice that there's a synagogue ruler greeting Jesus when they get back. So there's a high Jewish influence there. Where Jesus is going here, that's not the case. This is Gentile country. These are pagans. These are idolatrous people in the ancient world, a lot of supernaturalism. That's the land that Jesus is going to. And where there's supernaturalism, there's often demonic activity. When he got out on land, verse 27, a demon-possessed man from the town met him. This scene, like the previous scene, is recorded in multiple Gospels. Not in John, but Matthew and Mark both report this scene, and in the exact same sequence. Right after the storm, they get to the region of the Gerasenes, and this man greets them. For a long time, verse 27, he had worn no clothes. He did not stay in a house, but in the tombs. Luke's description in verse 27, as in Matthew and Mark, provides us with the degree of demonic influence. Remember earlier in chapter 4, there was a demon-possessed man where? In a synagogue. The degree of demonic influence that he was clothed, that he was in a synagogue, though he was acting out and Jesus rebuked the demon there and cast out that demon. Here, there's a greater degree, if you will, of demonic influence. Verse 28, when he saw Jesus, he cried out, fell down before him and said in a loud voice. And the demon's statement here in verse 28 mirrors almost exactly the statement of the demon in chapter 4 in the synagogue in Capernaum. What do you have to do with me, Jesus? And the way that the language works, it's somewhat of a comparison. What do you, being the Son of God, this demon fully recognizing who Jesus is, and this is a great irony if we read the Gospels well, the demons always get it. Their confessions are orthodox. The people's lives around them are often not responsive. That's some of the irony. What have you? You are the Son of God. You are the powerful one. You are that prophet. What do you have to do with me? It's a cowering. What do you have to do with me? It's a shrinking back kind of a statement. What do you have to do with me, Jesus? And notice the title, verse 28. You, Son of the Most High God. Follow titles in the Gospels. See how rarely they come up. Jesus will ascribe them to himself. Humans, rarely. Demons, frequently. They get it. They have a spiritual understanding of who Jesus is. You're the Son of the Most High God. And notice, this frame continues at the end of verse 28. What does the demon beg? Don't torment me. Why does he ask that? Because Jesus has the capacity to. There's a sense in which the scenes are being stacked up. He's powerful over the waves. Huge storm, experienced fishermen scared. In one moment, placid, exact calm, still, flat. This one could torment me. I'm in a weakened position. I could lose. Verse 29, because Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized this man. And although he was guarded, Luke here reminds us again, just as he did in verse 27, of the degree of demonic influence. Verse 27, the man didn't wear clothes. He was in the tombs. No one could control him. Oh, let me come back to that theme of no one can control him. Verse 29, this seized him, this demonic influence, and although he was guarded, bound by chains and shackles, he would snap the restraints and be driven by the demon into deserted places. To that one, Jesus asks, "What is your name?" He makes the demon confess. Notice the demon answers. Legion, he responds. Because many demons had entered the man, a legion of them, thought to be 1,000, if you will, legion, many. And they begged him, these together through this man, not to banish them to the abyss. It's here at verse 31, this idea of an abyss. We might think of an eternal condemnation, a place where there is absolutely no return. It's interesting, isn't it, that demons who are from the abyss, where Satan is, that's where they don't want to go back to. Verse 32, you're familiar with the scene. A large herd of pigs was there. Another evidence that they are in Gentile country. The demons begged him to permit them to enter the pigs. Fascinating as to why enter the pigs. And it seems that in the flow of this account, as with Matthew and Mark, these pigs become an observable demonstration of the legion's power outside of a human. This human had been dominated, and people think he's a freak. Well, why? Is it just him, or is it really something spiritual and demonic? By these coming out and going into a herd of swine, a herd of animals, and what these animals then do provides everyone a lesson in Jesus' power. Look what he can do. An observable, here is a test case for how much more powerful he is than this demon. And now he can free people. He uniquely can cleanse someone of this disease. And look at the result. The demons came out, verse 33, entered the pigs. This herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake that Jesus had just calmed, and they all drowned. When the men who tended those pigs saw what had happened, they ran. There's fear. There's fear and there's loss. If you are someone who tends animals in the ancient world, you're a steward of animals. Your job is to protect them. Your job is to make sure they graze where they need to graze, that they don't get away, because those pigs are a livelihood. This is a problem. Verse 35, those people went to see what had happened. They came to Jesus and found the man the demons had departed from. And Luke emphasizes the result. He's contrasting. Pigs are drowned. This man who used to have the demons. And notice, what does Luke describe as the other Gospels? He's sitting in his right mind. He's dressed. The result of the whole scene is that they're afraid, but it seems like the fear is leaning at this moment toward this man and seeing him changed. This is Jesus' power. He calmed a storm a moment ago, and it was exactly level, the water, and now he's taken this demon out of the man. Death has resulted for pigs, and this man is in his right mind. Verse 36, many eyewitnesses reported how the demon-possessed man had been delivered. You have people gathering from all around, a group who saw, and the group who were eyewitnesses reporting to those who gathered, this really happened, this really happened. Yes, it's the same man. The man who is legendary for the legion is now a testimony to what Jesus can do. The result? Verse 37. All the people of the Gerasene region asked him to come and join them, to lead a revival, to cast out any other demons, to bring in this prophetic message, verse 37. They asked him to stay and scatter more seed of the kingdom. They asked him to come and to preach the message of proclamation of freedom for the captives. Yes, yes, that's right. Isaiah 61, I see how this is all coming together. Yes, come and preach that message of Isaiah 61 here. Freedom for the captives, recovery of sight for the blind. Yes, this is the miracle worker. Come. No. What'd they say, verse 37? Get out. This you don't expect. If you've never read the Gospels before and you're reading this along, this would stop you. Why? You're not good soil. The worries of this life, the deceitfulness of riches, maybe. One commentator writes, these people have gathered from city and country, and now all from the region share in a common verdict. In fear, they reject Jesus. The offer of good news rebuffed, Jesus departs. Unlike the disciples in the boat, in spite of the unambiguous evidence of divine intervention before them in the form of their transformed acquaintance, these people seem not to have any faith at all. It may be that loss, fear of poverty concerns them. Their whole livelihood gone. Kent Hughes writes, "The Gerasenes, a practical lot, preferred pigs to people. The profits from the swine to the salvation of souls." 19th century English poet John Oxum wrote that this poem that Hughes quotes, "Rabbi, be gone. Thy powers bring loss to us and ours. Our ways are not as thine. Thou lovest men, we swine. Oh, get you hence, omnipotence, and take this fool of thine, his soul. What care for we for his soul? What good to us that thou hast made him whole, since we've lost our swine?" Hughes concludes, "Far more people than we imagine turn their backs on Christ or ask him to go away because they fear he will disrupt their lives." That is insightful. But you who are good soil, isn't that what you want? Turn that coin over a moment. What if your life is disrupted by omnipotence? What if your life is disrupted by complete grace and love? What if your life is disrupted by someone who knows good for you better than you or I do? That's a disruption I want! And this is the gospel. If you don't know Christ today, it very well may be that you are resisting him because of fear that he's going to disrupt your life. Friend, I smile with the greatest joy because God has disrupted mine. There is nothing better in the world that could happen to any human than God disrupts every plan you have. Recasts it according to love and grace, truth, discipline. I've heard many Christians say this, and I found it to be true. I've said it before as well. I look back before I was a believer, and the kinds of life I wanted, in the back of my mind, it really was wholeness, self-control, a sense of propriety and proportionality, things to make sense, things to fit together. And I was seeking it in a thousand means, but not the ends, until I was born again. And then I saw. All that I really wanted was in God. All that I wanted was in Him. That's true for you if you don't know Christ today. All the things you're really seeking, identity, security, somewhere to fit, empowerment to accomplish what you really want to do. It begins with forgiveness of sins. Receiving that, letting that disrupt you. Because there, in that humble position of repentance, God redoes the framework of your thinking. And right there, right at that moment, sets in motion a sequence of ideas and events for you to be disrupted by grace and holy love. This is the gospel. And if you have been disrupted, then you know the situation. Verse 38 and 39 read like your testimony. "The man from whom the demons had departed kept on begging him to be with him." Verse 38 is normal conversion. That's just normal. Someone who's been disrupted by holy love, by sovereignty and benevolence together, they just want to be with it. I said, seek after. It's a drug, and I've got to have it. I'm an addict. This I want and more. I cannot get enough. He wanted to be with Jesus. And you can imagine this man who'd been tormented, a cast off, made fun of, people afraid of him, alone, driven into deserted places, whole, simply by Jesus' word. Where would you want to go? With him? I'm with him. I don't know what tomorrow is, but I'm with him. Where he's at, you'll find me. His shadow, that's where I'm standing. He's been forgiven. This is holy love. Come to reside right here. And what did Jesus tell the man to do? To testify. Verse 39, go back to your home. Do you realize the whole social situation involved in verse 39? Go back to people who were afraid of you. Go back to people who ran from you. Go back to people who likely made fun of you. Go back to those who saw you unclothed in the tomb, saw people try to shackle you up and break away. Go back to them. Go back to people who saw your junk and go tell them what fixed you. And notice the theological lesson Luke wants to establish. Go tell all that God has done for you. And what does the verse say? He left and told all that Jesus had done for him. Joel Green writes, it is pivotal to the narrative that this man hears in the directive to speak of God's activity, a charge to speak of Jesus' activity. Unlike the disciples who were overcome with fear in the boat in the previous episode, this man, this Gentile, whose existence only moments before was determined by numerous demons and subhuman by almost any measure, recognizes Jesus as the one through whom God's salvific purpose is being enacted, i.e., Isaiah 61, right here. The prophet has come. He is proclaiming the year of the Lord's favor. He is setting the captives free. And because of that, he goes to witness. Notice verse 39. He went off proclaiming throughout the town all that Jesus had done for him. There are a number of strands that could be traced out from what we have observed this morning. Jesus' sovereign power over the sea despite the disciples' fear, and Jesus teaching them along the way with that beautiful, brief question. Just a gentle, interrogative rebuke. Where's your faith? As they head to this Gentile region of demonic influence, and the man rushes, and it's as if the demons are cowering before Jesus. They rush to him in confession. You're here, you know who we are. What between you and me? Have mercy. This one man out of all of this, cleansed in his right mind, despite the reaction of those who wish Jesus to go away, this man goes with great courage right there. What could compel that kind of courage? What could compel that kind of risk? What would compel someone to go back at one's own risk? It's experience of Jesus' power and love. It's what he has done. It's trusting his word. It's hearing his word, his command to endure, to follow, to bear fruit, and carrying it on. This is good soil. Good soil is soil that's been forgiven, that that's been transformed, that's experienced this benevolent sovereignty. Let's go back. Yes, I'll go. That's what compels Christian witness. Paul said it this way, for the love of Christ compels us. We are convinced that one died for all, therefore all have died. He died for all that we who live should no longer live for ourselves, but for Him. Let this be true of MCC. Together, this fellowship season, let our fellowship be to stimulate this kind of courageous, compelled witness.